All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 20 in this ancient history program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We've been talking about the pyramids, which are, as we've discussed, the ultimate lens for focusing our attention on archaic Egypt. The ultimate symbol of the values of Egyptian culture. So if we want to understand this archaic way of life, and we want present-centrically to study it and consider it and weigh it and try to draw connections, whatever they may be, to the life that we lead, we have to do it through this, by this means. We need this tether. We need this object, really literally a gigantic object to act as a bridge to that ancient past. And it focuses our every thought. It can help us to make sure that we are looking at things that truly matter. And that's what we talked about yesterday, was that these monument tombs, these gigantic, colossal works of engineering, are the best object we could possibly want, the greatest artifacts that we could possibly ask for in terms of clarifying for us the nature of a culture and of its values, because these monument tombs tell us what was important to the Egyptians. So they really are this clarifying, this piece of architecture that tells us about the values of the society, and help us to interpret everything that we are going to see about Egyptian history and make sense of it. So today what we're going to do is we'll talk a little bit more in detail about life in ancient Egypt and how the Egyptians came to build the pyramids, how that came to be kind of the centerpiece of Egyptian life. And then this will kind of take us into the nitty gritty of, you know, the real mechanics, the real structure of life back then, which is hard for us to grasp because it is archaic. It's hard for us to really put ourselves in, you know, in the place of the Egyptians and to understand their life and to understand how and why they would organize a society in a certain way. And then to ask really good, meaningful questions about that way of life and what its virtues were and what its problems were and think about why it ultimately collapsed. And eventually, right, tie this in with all the rest of our knowledge about human societies and the society that we're in now. And obtain whatever it is that we can out of this, this story of ancient Egypt, as different as it is from ours. So, let's talk about life in Egypt and what it was like under the pharaohs in more specific detail here. So, first of all, we go all the way back to circa 3000 BC, and we've got Menes Nimer unifying ancient Egypt. That's our anchor fact. We've got this as our boundary event that really starts all of history in motion. We have the unification of Egypt. It's one of these grand scale events illustrated on the Narmer palette. But in a way, when we have a really big event like that, we've got to concretize it. We've got to, you know, fill it in with the reality of it and connect it to life and understand why it is that we are marking history with an event like that and what its use is and how it can help us with all of the rest of the stuff that we are studying. Because it is a very, very useful fact. And it really sets the conditions for everything that we're going to study. So we've got this event where Mannes-Neimer, I don't have the tablet in front of, on my screen here. I suppose I could bring up the tablet, right? But he's, abstractly, we have this vision of what's happening, right? We have the ruler of Upper Egypt on their map is conquering Lower Egypt. We keep rehearsing this, right? Like a mantra almost. We keep kind of bringing this back up and restating it. And then we looked at the Narmer palette and we said, okay, what does that look like? We see the ruler depicted as a supersized human with the crowns, and we see the dead vanquished soldiers and everything. And then we're getting an idea that, okay, unification means conquest, it means bloodshed, it means a war on a vast scale, a lot of destruction. Okay, so this is one of those things that punctuates history. We see it a lot. History is sadly very full of large-scale violence like that. Okay, but as far as getting kind of Egyptian history underway, we have to now kind of ask, well, okay, what does life look like after that? What does this conquest do? What does it not do? What is life really like? And how do we get the pyramids from there, right? Because we got two anchor facts. We haven't quite got the second one, the pyramids, yet. We've got the first one. We've got Mannes-Neimer is conquering Lower Egypt. He's unifying Egypt. And then we have the pyramids. We've got these two things, and we're kind of juggling them. We haven't quite got them connected in our minds yet, not really well. So that's the thing that we're going to try to do here today, is really forge that connection and make them understandable. I think a hand shot up there, so I didn't want to miss that. If there was a question, Theo, go ahead.
So I was interested. I was looking at one of the other maps, and it looks like, well, Lower Egypt's a whole lot smaller than Upper Egypt, but Lower Egypt's got that huge, fertile bunch where Upper Egypt only got a little bit, so maybe they were about equal in.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, and I think that what you just said is exactly right, that Lower Egypt, you know, in terms of the size of it, it's deceptive, because this is a really big area, whereas this is just a single corridor along the Nile. There's nothing else over here and over here, right? I mean, it's just the corridor, and it really only gets you to about the first cataract. The truth, you know, there's some life that extends further down than that. But the purpose of marking the cataracts on here was to help you to understand that this is the limit to Egypt. It doesn't go further than that. And then down here, there's another kingdom called Nubia that's archaic and prehistoric, and we don't know anything about it, but we know that it's there from Egyptian sources. So yeah, it's not that much. It's really not that much bigger. It's probably, in fact, Lower Egypt was bigger. And this is all Egypt was. One curiosity is Upper Egypt, Lower Egypt, the terminology is a little bit, can be confusing. And I remember, and it always makes me smile, I asked a few years ago, I asked the students, you know, why is Lower Egypt marked on top of Upper Egypt? Why are they called, you know, where does this terminology come from? And Timothy, who was at a lower level, had a really clever and funny answer. Do you remember what your answer was, Timothy?
No.
You don't? Oh, that's funny. All right, so I'll tell you what Timothy's answer was when he was younger. His answer was, I said, well, okay, why is Upper Egypt under Lower Egypt? Why is, what do you think it means? Why do we use the term Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt? And Timothy gave a really clever answer. And that was, he said, well, Upper Egypt, maybe Upper Egypt is the place where all the rich people live. So I thought that was a kind of a brilliant answer, because it was kind of like a sociological answer. He was saying our terminology, you know, reflects, you know, the hierarchy in society. I thought that was a very The word for it is precocious answer because it was intelligent and kind of interpretive. So the simple answer is it's just a matter of geography, right? The terrain here is higher and rivers flow downhill to the sea. So this is literally lower in terms of altitude, and this is higher in terms of altitude. This is upper. Of course, why is Lower Egypt illustrated on the map above Upper Egypt? What does that reflect? Which is something to know about maps in general. If this is upper, why wouldn't we maybe put that at the top? What's going on here?
Well, the trend is to put northern stuff as up.
Yeah, right. So the convention in geography is to put the north at the top. We've got, ever since a compass points north, right? And so that became a geographical convention. Most of the land masses of the world and most of the early cultures of the world were in the northern hemisphere. So there tended to be an orientation to geography that put the North Pole at the top, and maps had that convention. Not all maps were like that, and some ancient maps are, what we would think of as upside down or oriented in all directions. But the modern convention, which is very helpful, is that maps always have north at the top. So that way, you just open up any map and you know what you're looking at. Now, it's not always the case. So sometimes, if north is not at the top, then what you need on a map is a what's called a Rosetta, I believe, or a rose that shows the where north really is. So you will sometimes see, an arrow on a map that's pointing off to the side, and that says, "Well, we have decided because of, some purpose of ours in building this particular map that north is going to be this way." And there's different reasons why geographers will diverge from the convention, but most maps have north at the top. So that's all. That's why the maps are like this. All right, so like I said, we've got Menes-Nimer. He is unifying Upper and Lower Egypt. This is this grand scale violent war, right? Historical event. But now what I want to challenge you guys to think about is how this relates to regular life. What was regular life like? And how did this event impact that? And how did this Menes-Nimer become this? By what mechanism, by what apparatus did his rule extend over the populace, and what does that look like? What does life really look like? In a way, it's really simple, as we're going to see, because archaic life was really simple compared to modern life. But on the other hand, it's not simple because for us, it requires an act of historical imagination, and it requires us to, make that leap out of our personal context into this past that is so foreign to us and really take it seriously and understand how it worked. If we do, then we can get a pretty clear picture. We'll have another dimension to this story of Menes-Nimer. We'll have this other layer in our understanding of the pyramids, and we'll be able to connect them together. So, Menes-Nimer conquers Lower Egypt. All right, again. Okay, what about regular life? What happens to the regular people? You got a war. Devastating, of course. A lot of regular people die. Abby?
Asked what happened to the regular people before you said we get a war that starts seeing a lot of regular people die, I was going to say, will they get forced to go to war or to work? The
Okay.
pharaohs.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So they get swept up by these historical forces, these historical events, right? Okay, true, right? But now let's say Menes-Nimer has unified the country. Now what? Now keep going with that, Abby. Now what happens, right? Because then we get into the part that's not in the history books and that's not the anchor fact, but it's life. So tell me about life, Abby.
Well, I reckon once they unify Upper and Lower Egypt, then their ruler changes, they're working for a different person, they might be doing different things, and they've also been brought, Upper and Lower Egypt being unified has brought the people of Upper Egypt and the people of Lower Egypt together, and they might not like each other. And
okay.
So they will have arguments, maybe little skirmishes, fights.
Okay, that's interesting.
And
okay. So that you're kind of staying on this track of what would kind of be the politics of ancient Egypt. What I want to encourage you to do now and ask everybody to think along these lines is just regular life, mundane, day-to-day life. Once all of these, really huge scale things happen, and the thing that we're going to always mark history by, okay, then life resumes, right? And cultures and ancient civilizations are just like ours. Most days, you don't have an event that changes the world, right? Most days are not anchor fact days, right? So what's happening day after day, year after year, decade after decade after Menes and Narmer? What's happening there? What does that look like? Keep going, Abby.
Well, there are people cutting lotus stalks and selling them at the Nile, making papyrus, doing gold work, stone cutting, building pyramids.
Well, not yet. Wait. We're not going to get to the pyramids for another 350 years. But the other stuff that you were saying was really good. Regular life resumes, which means, a much lower variety of tasks than we are used to thinking of, right? So basically, by far, more than 95% of the population is basically consumed, their days are consumed by doing what? Juliet?
Farming.
Yeah. Obtaining food by whatever means, and we have agriculture along the Nile, so that problem's been solved at this point in history, at least in Egypt it has been, right? They're not nomads, they're not foraging, they're not kind of moving around like animals. They are settled in a certain place. They have learned how to grow food in sufficient quantity to support life on a certain scale. But it's hard. It's really hard. What about kids? What do they do? Theo?
Well, I mean, they learn trades. They get apprenticed to someone if they're lucky.
Yeah, if they're not part of that 95%. So what does the 95% do?
They just farm. I mean, your father farms, you're going to farm, and your children are going to farm too.
Yeah, so you get up in the morning, and you're going to do the farming chores. I mean, that's going to be your day. And so you're going to get a bucket and go down to the river and get some water, or if you got a well or what have you, and you're going to, take care of the animals. You're going to, I don't know, I'm not a farmer, so I don't have a really good sense of all of those things that they do. But, even today, a farmer is really somebody that farms, and that's a job. That's a full-time job taking care of all the different aspects of that. And there are seasons to it, and there's different things you're doing at different parts of the year, but it's a fully absorbing activity. Never mind before industrial technology. Right? So, when you get up in the morning, you're not turning on the TV and relaxing with a coffee. You're going out and starting a fire. You got to start one yourself. You might have a little clay oven or something like that, right? And some clay pottery, and you might be heating up some water. If you want to drink some water, you got to sanitize it, so you got to boil it, and so on, right? I mean, and maybe if you've got beans or whatever, then you've got to be boiling them, otherwise they're not edible, and you've got to be, picking this, and if there's grain to be harvested and all that, oh my gosh, it's all just nonstop drudgery compared to modern life, right? I mean, when I got up this morning, Right? I mean, I was in a nice, comfortable, air-conditioned home, and I went to the bathroom, and I sat on the throne, and that's running water, and that's all the wonders of modern technology. And then I got up, and I my method is to boil a cup of water in the microwave. It's really fast. And then make myself a cup of coffee, and a variety of things, I turned on the light, and the electricity is flowing, and all of that stuff, right? It's just so luxurious, it's unbelievable. Yeah? And I've got wonderful raw milk in the fridge, and I take the cream and I make my coffee with it. It's spectacular. And it's just beautiful. I mean, the conveniences of modern life. Well, back then, your life was just this constant drudgery, and that was the reality of, life for everybody. And so this is what I'm trying to do here, is kind of paint this picture of life at the bottom, because we don't want to have a disconnect between all of the real stuff that's going on in everybody's lives and then these grand scale anchor facts. We got to have the ability to shuttle back and forth between those levels in our awareness. And we got these regular people, and they are farming. And so what is their connection, right? What is their connection to the Menes Narmers? How does that work? What do you see in terms of what are these bonds that make up society? Right? That's the question that I'm asking. You got all these regular folks, they're farming. And Theo was suggesting, okay, yes, some people have trades and some are carpenters and so on. So yeah, and they're trading their services, and we have some of these bonds in society. Where people trade, they barter because there's no money. So this is very primitive life. And so within a certain community, people's lives kind of unfold. Okay, what unifies that? What turns that into a single culture, a single civilization? Is government. But how does that work? How does that work, Theo?
Well, so the pharaoh, who is their god king, can do basically whatever they want, and there's a pretty strict feudal system where all of the farmers are supporting the pharaoh, and the pharaoh literally owns everything.
Okay, hold on, stop there, because you've said so much, and we gotta watch out about certain things like terminology, like feudal. So we're gonna avoid that term for the moment, even though it's a useful one. But the essence of what you're saying there is that these farmers, these regular folks, all of these people in the society, right? They are supporting this upper strata. But the pharaoh doesn't farm. He's the god king. Right? He doesn't get down in the dirt. He doesn't carry buckets. He doesn't scoop the stuff and whatever. The nitty-gritty again, right? The pharaoh is the god king, and so there's this big disconnect between him and the people. There's a whole layer there that we've got to discuss, how a society functions. And so ultimately, we're going to use the term government, right? It's a very broad abstraction, but when we think about government, we're thinking about this layer in society that provides a certain structure, right? And that enforces a set of rules in the society, right? And so there's a lot of different kinds of governments. Back then, we're talking about, this organization, it's got a bunch of different types of people in it, with the pharaoh at the top, giving the orders, and enforcing a certain way of life. Really, the people at the bottom, right, are ciphers, which is a good word for it. If you want a good vocabulary term, let me go ahead and chant that word to you. Cipher. Okay, the people at the bottom are ciphers. They're disposable, minute components, constituents of the society. And the pharaoh is, the one who's in charge of the whole thing, and the people down at the bottom are doing what they can to survive. They're growing food. and they can do a certain amount. And then, of course, well, the Pharaoh's not doing that, so he's got to get food from them. And here we have this aspect of every society, which is the fact that a government is not a productive apparatus. In essence, a government does not produce anything. So, in order to function, a government has to obtain resources from the people. And in a word, what does it take from them in order to structure society? Juliet.
Taxes,
in a word. Okay, key term, right? We have these layers in society, and the thing that binds the two layers is the fact that the government layer taxes the lower layer. Okay, and so this is what supports the Pharaoh, because he's not going to grow food for himself. He's a god king, and all of his entourage and all of those privileged people are non-productive. But they got to live too. How do they live? Well, they live by taking the resources of the society and leveraging that to their own benefit. So they tax the people. And every government that has ever existed has levied taxes on its population. And this is a really fundamental relationship that exists between people and governments. And it's so important that, you know, well-functioning societies have, successful societies have tax systems that work. I mean, this really is another one of these crucial things that we have to understand. At any time in history, you gotta look for a society. It's gonna have a government. It's gonna have the people. And what's that taxation relationship? It's gonna be one of those essences that you want to understand. And, you know, we have anger facts in our history of the world that are based on that. In case it hadn't occurred to you, 1776 is one of them. Right? Because what's that about? Right? The United States doesn't exist without a crisis in this arrangement. Theo?
Well, the king is taxing the people. Mm-hmm. Without even asking or even representing them, which mm-hmm. isn't going to help, but still.
Mm-hmm. Right. No taxation without representation. We've got the Stamp Act rebellion. And then we've got, you know, this escalating crisis over the issue of, well, taxation is fundamentally a problem of rights. And you know, we get this articulation of a new idea concerning the relationship between the government and the people, a new system in which taxation is minimized to a degree that is just absolutely shocking. And the people are liberated, and the government is caged, and a whole different way of life is made possible, and human beings flourish on this earth for the first time ever. So, back in Egypt, we don't have that arrangement yet. We don't have anybody capable of figuring that out. We have the supposed God King, and he's got an apparatus whereby he can take advantage of this lowly nature of the poor people who are barely able to grow their own food. And so he's got his army. He's got his, you know, people that can wield physical force, and he's got a taxation apparatus, and he's going to take some of that from them. So this is regular life. Regular life is people in Egypt, right? This is, regular life is people living their lives, growing enough food to survive, and then the God King taking some of it. All right. So, and all of this, because it's Egypt, revolves around the Nile. So what happens is every year the Nile floods and it deposits the soil that is newly fertile and got all the minerals and nutrients for the food, right? And then they plant their crops. And the government then has to figure out how to act in such a way to maintain the society. And the Egyptians had this within their government. There was a caste within the government that was in charge of taxation, They had a device that helped them to figure out how to do it. It was called a nilometer. Rosie, did you want to interject here?
Well, I was going to say something about that.
Go ahead.
Well, we've been reading this book about Egyptians, and I learned that how they used it was if the water was to a certain place, then they would charge a certain amount of money for the taxes, because that's how much money, how much food they were going to make. And then if it was low, then they would charge less because there wouldn't be very much food.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay, you're exactly right. So that's good. I'm glad you're reading about that. So this is actually a medieval one. This is not from ancient Egypt. This is from medieval times. But it's same concept. Really cool. There's an island in the middle of the Nile, and the water flows into this big basin, this chamber here, and you've got this huge ruler, the shaft, which is just basically a really big ruler. And you measure how high the water goes. And as Rosie is saying, if the flood that you're measures a certain amount, then you know approximately how productive the crops are going to be. And you know how much to tax, because we have this fundamental problem and challenge in the relationship between the regular folks and the Menes Narmers. If they tax too much, then eventually there's a rebellion. If they tax too little, well, then maybe they don't have control over the people. So there's a delicate balance in a society on how you order the behavior, right? Especially since you don't have a society of individual rights. So you don't have a fundamentally benevolent system. So you gotta watch it. It's very delicate. You gotta watch out how you do this, because if your rule is oppressive, if it's tyrannical, it will break down. And as we'll see, it breaks down periodically in Egypt, as it does everywhere else, because the arrangement is fundamentally unstable. But the Egyptians would measure the flood, and that would help the bureaucracy of the government to determine what the level of taxation should be. And when we say taxation, there's no money back then. So this is still archaic human life. There's no money. So it's direct taxation. It's literally a portion of the crops. Or, as we're going to see, you know, with regard to the pyramids, or direct labor, right? Literally your time, a certain amount of your life is being taken directly in barter. So either way, right, you've got a certain amount to give, and the government's going to take it from you. The nilometer is a kind of device for the Egyptian IRS to know how much to take. Theo, go ahead.
It also kind of gives you a system to make sure that people farm as much crops as possible, because you're going to tax them this much because you know they can produce this much.
Well,
so they actually have to produce that much, otherwise they're not going to have enough food.
I suppose you could look at it that way, but I don't think that's actually the main thing, just because nobody in their right mind would produce less than they could, right? Because there was no surplus. Okay, in pre-industrial societies, famine was a continual threat. So you never, opted to do less than you could. You might try to hide it. But so there, if you're the taxation officials, right, you're going to know what the productivity level should be. And that means that you won't allow people to get away with smuggling, what governments call smuggling, which means, privately producing and trading without the government's permission. And so you won't let them do that. So that's kind of more the angle of it if you want a really robust system of taxation. So along the way here, the pharaohs, they've got their system and so on, but they're being buried in tombs that look like this. So as far as, kind of developing a really interesting system of God-King government, right, this tomb is Not much to speak of. These are called mastaba tombs. And if ever Merneith Narmer's tomb is found 100%, it'll look like this. Or maybe even less impressive. So, you know, this is just a few layers of stone. The structure of it architecturally is like this, where you've got the layers of stone and then there's a channel underneath and the tomb is down here underground. But, you know, it's really plain. It's really small by comparison to the pyramids. And it has none of that kind of, what are we going to call it? Curb appeal would be a modern term, right? For the architectural, you know, level of impressiveness, right? And so this has no monument tomb power to it, right? So the early Egyptian culture doesn't quite have this fully, you know, developed quality to it yet. We're only going to get that when we get to the age of the pyramids. Then we're going to get the really symbolic Egyptian culture. We're going to get this invention, literally the invention of the pyramids, and of this design for the monument tomb. We have an architect who is credited with this. His name is Imhotep. There he is in your chat box. And so his name is associated with the development of the pyramid as an architectural device. And this is the pyramid, the first major pyramid called the Step Pyramid of the Pharaoh Djoser. Djoser, I think, is how it's spelled. And what it is, you can see how it's not exactly a great leap forward in architecture. All it is one tomb and then a smaller one over top, right? And then a smaller one over top, and then you get a pyramid. So the idea of building a pyramid is really straightforward if this is your method, right? If you know how to build the rectangular portion, then you just build a smaller one on top of a smaller one on top of a smaller one. It's still pretty colossal. There's the people down there in the corner. There's two people sitting there. So it's still about the width of a football field, the length of a football field, which is pretty big. It's about 200 feet high as well. So, you know, this is where we're starting to get into the colossal architecture. We're starting to get into the idea of projecting the grandeur of the pharaoh. And so they're going to try and make bigger and bigger pyramids. Rosie, go ahead.
It looks to me in the picture like it's made of bricks, not the stone.
Yeah, you see, so that's a good point. Now, I think it is still stones. So I'm not an expert, but you'd have to look it up. I'm pretty sure it's still quarried stones, but they are smaller. So it's going to take a while before they can kind of build up their method and their technique, right? But that's a good observation that we're talking about a smaller structure. And it's hard to maintain this. It's hard to construct it, in fact, because the taller that it gets, the heavier that it gets. And so as pyramid design was evolving, and here's people down here again, just to give you the scale, right? This is definitely of a similar size. So as pyramid designs, they're trying to build them taller and taller. But some of the pyramids that have been found that were built at this higher angle, they collapsed. They could not sustain their own weight. And because there is a little bit there are hollow areas within the pyramid, so it's a little bit of a tricky design. So if you build them too heavy, they collapse. So this is a funny one because it's called the bent pyramid because it starts at one angle and then it continues at another angle so that you can build it as high as you can, but you can't go too high. So this is trying to kind of build as big of a pyramid as possible because you know how kings are, right? Each king's got to have a bigger pyramid than the one that came before because each king has to be kind of the greatest. Right? And there's actually a funny story about that when it comes to the pyramid complex at Giza. These pyramids were built in the following order. This one back here is the pyramid of Khufu. It was built first. This is the pyramid of Khafre. It was built second. And this is the Pyramid of Menkaure, and it was built last. And these are the pyramids of the queens and less important officials. So they're smaller, they're not as important. But they're built in this order, and it's kind of interesting. Khufu's pyramid, this one back here, is actually the largest. But of course, this is a massive pyramid, and biggest ever. But notice how this one kind of seems like it's bigger. And this was, this is just one of those funny things about the story of, you know, you can kind of get a little bit of an insight into the pettiness of the mindset of the rulers, right? Khafre was Khufu's son, and he could not, his pyramid is smaller, but he built it on a slightly higher spot. So consequently, it looks bigger. So, you know, this is kind of one of those funny little things that you kind of sometimes have. So it looks bigger than Khufu's, but it's not. Menkaure, I guess, didn't have the ability to leverage as much labor in order to build his. Maybe by that point, people were kind of tired of building pyramids. So he had to settle for a smaller one. I don't know. This literally is the peak of Egyptian culture. In other words, no pharaoh was ever able to build something this big again. So they got this big, and then they never got this big. They started getting smaller, and then they disappeared after that. So this was the peak. This was the maximum level of pharaonic power, rule, what have you. The whole construct of the god king peaked literally and figuratively with this complex. So Theo says, I don't know how they could possibly get tired of building pyramids. That sounds like a joke. I think you're joking there. But as a real question, well, why did they stop? Okay, is something that we have to wrap our heads around. So we're going to end with that here. If you've got, people are starting to peel off because it's 11:30. Rosie may have read about that a little bit. And we'll talk about that starting Monday. And again, the answer comes, and much of history, you know, we have to have this good sense of the reality of life, right? This, not the Menes Narmer part, but the part about how Menes Narmer got his taxes. Not just the pyramid of Khufu and Khafre and so on, but what their life was like. And how they were able to actually get this done, and what stress it put on the society, and, you know, at what point did it break, right? How did it not, how could they couldn't sustain it. And so we're going to talk about the reality of the life of the pharaoh, right? This character in our previous painting. He's a god king, he's a man, right? And his life is real. His life is guarded by men with swords. His life is recorded by scribes. He is supported by the priests. And he has to have somebody to wave the fan. And he's a man, so he needs to have a woman in his life, and so on, right? I mean, it's real. So when we get to this, you know, when we're talking about this question next time about the age of the pyramids, the pyramids, we understand them as these monuments to these god kings and these constant reminders of their presence and power in the life of the regular people who are going to be taxed and who've got to put up with it. And there's got to be a compelling reason for them to do that. Right? There's the use of force, but then you have this other layer to it, which is the religious belief that motivates them and it keeps them in line. So society works in its own way, in this own archaic structure. It works this way. But then it breaks down. So the the way that it works, you know, we have to understand the mechanics of it, right down to the nilometer and the floods and the crops and the taxes. That's how it works. But then how does that break? In order to know more about that, in order to understand that, we have to embrace the reality of the pharaoh and the details of the life of the god king. And when we see that in detail, we'll get it. We'll understand why this is a very delicate social structure, why it is not a very, it's not resilient, and why ultimately it's simply going to go extinct. All right, so we're going to talk about that next week. The history of Egypt following the pyramids. We go from Menes Narmer to the pyramids. The pyramids peak. I mean, they start building the pyramids circa 2650 BC. That's the time of Imhotep. And then the peak in the age of pyramids comes around circa 2500 BC. And they stop building pyramids about 2150 BC. So the age of pyramids is about 500 years of Egyptian history out of 3000. And that's it. And then we're not going to see pyramids anymore. So we'll get into kind of the detail here of what's going on after the pyramids, after the pyramid complex in Giza. What we're going to do is we'll talk about the structure of Egyptian government, how it worked, and that will point out kind of what the fault lines are, what the weaknesses are, and how it's not, you know, what happened. We'll understand how it broke repeatedly, put back together, broke again, put back together, broke again, and basically how it stagnated at that level, because it was not a society of individual rights. It was always going to be stuck at a certain plateau. And consequently, eventually, it was overrun. It just did not progress because it couldn't progress. And eventually, others were more powerful and it went by the wayside. All right, so we'll get to that next week. Of course, tomorrow is History Through Art. So, next painting. That's it for me. Final thoughts, questions? All right, folks. Have a good one. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye-bye.
Bye.